good. I think I'll just try to be a better judge of it.
It just changes it completely.
Yeah. Okay, finally, what you've been waiting for, Yellowstone Park, through the lens of Scripture. We have been actually in what we call the Yellowstone ecosystem or Yellowstone country. It includes all of the stuff around Yellowstone Park. Yellowstone Park is just the government-sanctioned area done in the late 1800s of Yellowstone Park. But the whole Yellowstone country goes outside those boundaries. That's why when I have these kits I make on Yellowstone Park, and they all have tons of samples, volcanic samples in them. And the number one question I get asked is, did you break the law? I mean, how'd you get these samples? Well, here's how I find them. I know where the boundary is, and so I step out of the boundary, wave to the ranger, and that's where I start doing my collecting. It's not against the law. And the volcanoes aren't partial to government boundaries. When they exploded, they left all kinds of earmarks all over the place. And so we're going to be able to do some collecting as we go there. Parents, be sure to have your kids bring some buckets. One of my favorite tools to travel with is a bucket. And wife usually drives, and I'll tell her, pull over here. And so she'll get her book out and read, and I'll do my collecting. And yeah, you can find a lot of stuff. And road cutouts along U.S. highways, some of the best places to look for rocks. You look like an idiot, but you look homeless and look like you're looking for food or something. You know, but they're really a lot of fun. Okay, Yellowstone Park through the lens of Scripture. First of all, geology. The word geology means, it's two Greek words, meaning the study of the earth. It involves two things. It involves the science, that is modern geology now. It involves the science, and that is the chemistry and the properties of what you're looking at. And it also involves the history, the how and the when. Now, it would be wonderful if when you take your earth history course in college or high school or whatever it is, that teachers would be upfront about this and tell you, look, this is a real mix here. We're going to study the science, and we're going to study an idea about how the science came to be. That would be wonderful. But we don't. Modern geology mixes these subjects and calls the package science. And it's up to us then to do the homework and figure out what is science and what is philosophy. Well, here's my biblical framework. Genesis 7:11, a big part of it. The fountains of the great deep burst open. This ought to be one of those life verses we put on the list, of John 3:16 and a few others. This is a pretty important life verse because this will help you interpret a lot of stuff out there. Second of all, Genesis 8:3, and the waters receded steadily from the earth. This is not just a historical statement, it's a geological statement. If any of you have played with the hose and ruined your parents' backyard like I did as a kid, and carved canyons and valleys and everything else in the garden, you will see that receding floodwaters and advancing floodwaters have an effect on the landscape. And so this is important verse. And Psalm 104, verses 5 through 9, the mountains rose and the valleys sank down. These statements are historical and geological. Now, the geology of the park is mostly of catastrophic origin and of three areas: flood, volcanism, and ice. And so we're going to look at each one of those areas. First of all, the flood. We're going to be exhaustive here, but we're going to take a look at a few things. In the Yellowstone ecosystem, isn't that a neat green word? I love using that word, ecosystem. The Yellowstone country, as others would call it. Yellowstone country. Right around Bozeman, you're going to notice this group of mountains, part of the Rocky Mountains, called the Bridger Mountains. These Bridger Mountains, they're made up of limestone and sandstone, and there's estimated to be 27,000 feet of sedimentary rock. A sedimentary rock is rock laid down by water and mud. Okay, wait a minute. That's not a slow and gradual phenomenon. That requires some big catastrophic stuff to explain that. That's 5 miles thick of sedimentary rock. That whole mountain. It's an amazing feature. I've been up in there. And everywhere you go, limestone, sandstone, clay, all these sedimentary rocks. Wonderful example of really flood-borne deposits. And then, of course, there's been some sculpting afterwards. Then here is a picture of Mount Everts. We're going to look at this. Many people just gloss right over this because they're focused in on Mammoth Hot Springs. Mammoth, we're going to get to spend some time at. Wonderful geologic feature. But in the backdrop of Mammoth, and that's a volcanic feature, but in the backdrop is this mountain called Mount Everts. Everts was a guy who was honored. It's really an incredible story of survival. He got separated from I think he was on the Hayden exploration party in the 1800s before Yellowstone became a park. So they were exploring the park. He got separated. And trying to find his way out, he was lost for, almost a month. And he lost his weapons. He lost all his clothes. And he wandered out one day, delirious, you know, naked. His bones were, you know, his flesh was, it hadn't eaten. He didn't know how to live off the land. He was some businessman, I think, from Helena, and he joined the party. And he survived. And his story is really an incredible story. There's nobody up there. There weren't any rangers. There weren't Indians avoided Yellowstone for the most part. There were some who ventured in, but for the most part, they bypassed Yellowstone because they thought it was inhabited by all kinds of spirits. I mean, you can imagine seeing this stuff for the first time. In fact, I think it was when John Coulter, I believe, came back. It was either him or Bridger, one of those two explorers, in the early days, came out of there and began reporting stories. They all thought he was nuts. And, I think it was Coulter who called the place where Yellowstone is the place where hell bubbled over. And, you know, they just thought he was nuts, made good drinking stories and bar stories, but no one gave it a second thought because no one had seen it. It had been unexplored. But anyway, this is Mount Everts. Now, this has a classic unconformity. Remember we talked about unconformities last night where you have two layers of rock on top of each other with several million years missing in between. And there's no hint that that time is missing because the layers are right on top of one another. And that's called an unconformity. And Mount Everts has one of those. Here's the unconformity. If you look at the mountain, there are flat contacts. You see the arrow where it says unconformity? I don't know how clear it is up there. Did you put that arrow up there, sweetie? Yeah, go ahead. You have shale marine deposits that are 85 million years old. There's 80 million years missing. Can you give me that first one there? Okay, here we go. See the layers of shale? That's all sedimentary. And then there's this unconformity. You see where that is? It's a flat contact. And then you have the Huckleberry Tuff, they gave it a name, it's volcanic material. The Huckleberry Tuff is 2.1 million years old, according to their dating. Everything underneath that is 85 million years old. Well, there's a lot of time missing there. That's unaccounted for, isn't there? But look, they're stacked right on top of each other. Well, geologists recognize this, but they say, well, it's because one or two things didn't happen. Either erosion took it all away and left no evidence, or there was no deposition going on in that 80 million years or so. And that's the end of the story, and they go on. But you see, absence, there's no evidence that any erosion took place, and there's no evidence that would say differently than these layers were laid down fairly rapidly on top of one another. There is no missing time. But these unconformities are all over the world. Grand Canyon has a number of them. Everywhere you go, and I'm sure you'll find them out here in the Front Range. So if you put this in kind of a biblical order of events, If you think about our biblical order, you've got, well, the first thing, the sediments were laid down by the flood, and they contained all kinds of dead things. Mount Everest is a real mystery because it contains not only invertebrate fossils, ones without backbones, sea creatures, marine creatures, they're mixed in with vertebrate land fossils. And they're all jumbled and mixed together. And it was almost as if it was washed in from some other place and deposited there. And so that's really the action of the flood. Then, second of all, you have receding floodwaters from tectonic activity of the flood, planed and scraped the newly formed sediments as well as folded them. This is important. You cannot fold sedimentary rock without heating it again and melting it, partial melt, and destroying the fossils within it. These are fossils, are amazing finds they're finding here. So those sediments had to have been folded while they were still somewhat pliable, like clay almost. And as the receding waters then took off a lot of it, you only have this big mountain that's sitting there. And all the rest of the sediments have been washed. Now, incidentally, a lot of sediments from the continent have been located in off the coast of San Francisco and in the Gulf of Mexico. Well, with receding floodwaters, you would expect, where would the sediments go? A lot of them were deposited west in the Colorado Plateau. In fact, geologists will tell you the sandstone there is probably from the Appalachian Mountains. Well, how did they get there? Yeah, you got the Appalachian Mountains here, the Colorado Plateau here, and all that sand came from the Appalachian Mountains. How did that happen gradually and of low geologic energy? It had to have taken a huge catastrophe to do that. Same way with Mount Everest. And then after the receding of the floodwaters are coming down, you got this mountain sitting there, then you've got volcanic activity from the Yellowstone eruptions. Now, volcanoes that have erupted underwater have certain signatures. And some of this is true in Yellowstone. Some of it's true in the Columbia Plateau up in Washington. Some of the lava underneath has been formed underwater. And so we can kind of guess that this is from probably late flood stage volcanism. And the same way with Yellowstone. Now, we've got this stuff being deposited directly on top of the shales and the sedimentary rock. Massive flooding then from melting glaciers created the huge V-cut canyons down through Gardner. You're going to see a lot of this as you drive up into Yellowstone, driving up quite an incline from Gardner up toward Mammoth. You're going to be driving, winding through this V-cut canyon, huge boulders laying all the way down it. And you're going to say, wow, this is a lot of water came down here. And I don't think it's necessarily from the flood, but from probably melting glaciers, a big flood. And those are deposited all over the place. And then you have subsequent ongoing erosion has continued to produce landslides. So you see how the biblical frame, you can take the biblical framework, and it's fixed. Creation, sin, the flood, history of Israel, appearance of the Messiah, the church, and the end. That's fixed, isn't it? We may not know all the real details, but that much is fixed. We don't start at the back of the book and work and construct it as we go. That is fixed. That's our framework. And so we take that framework, kind of like one of these plastic sheets, and we lay it over these geology formations that we're seeing, and then we start constructing a history. And I think some of the individual local things can probably be tweaked here and there, but the framework doesn't change. And that's unlike secular geology. The framework changes all the time. From when I was a kid, slow and gradual geology. And if I used the word catastrophe in any of my papers, I would have flunked. Because it was a dirty word. You didn't say that. The guy who came up with continental drift in the early 1900s was considered a wacko. And then in the 70s, all of this stuff began to radically change. The older geologists were dying off, much to the delight of the younger geologists, because now they could do their studying and get their grants and things without fear of being persecuted. And they started to tell a different story. Well, now we're going to add catastrophes in. I remember the first time I saw a book on the Cascade geology and the title of it, and I about snapped my neck. I looked at it, and I did a double take. It was called The Catastrophic Origin of the Cascade Mountains. I said, what do we got, a creation book here? No, it was just done in the new thinking. So over long ages, millions, hundreds of millions of years, we got punctuated catastrophes here, just not the big one. No, can't allow that in the door. But we got a bunch of smaller ones. So this is our framework, okay? Now, let's go to volcanism. Yellowstone Park, you cannot get through Yellowstone without talking about volcanism and earthquakes. As many as 3,000 earthquakes a year under Yellowstone. And I tell the moms, don't be surprised if you feel a few at night. And they all thank me profusely for telling them that information. And, you know, and then when I tell them, okay, we're now inside the crater, that gets a few shrieks. Yeah, so Yellowstone. When I was a kid, Yellowstone was looked at as isolated geysers and hot springs and so on. It's kind of an interesting phenomenon about the changing earth. And but then in the 70s, you see, after we started permitting the word catastrophe in the definition of things, now all of a sudden Yellowstone was seen as a supervolcano, a huge eruption, probably the biggest eruption in Earth's history, took place right here. They know that, or they guess that, by the size of the rim. The one that we'll be in is about 45 miles long and about 30 miles wide. One of the eruptions is 72 miles long, stretches all the way into Idaho. Can you imagine a volcanic eruption that size? That is huge. Just one of the eruptions let go over 900 times what Mount St. Helens produced in the way of ash and pyroclastic material and all this kind of stuff that comes out of volcanoes. Okay, now if you look at the map here, you see the main caldera that we'll be in, 45 miles long, and some estimates place a little less, some place a little bit more than 35 miles wide. We'll stop in an area right outside of Cook City when we're in the Beartooth and let the kids get up and play around on this landslide. It's always fun. Moms don't learn much geology right then, but you'll enjoy it. It's really a neat thing because it's all this, what we call rhyolite lava. This is from one of the eruptive cycles of Yellowstone. It's a very interesting rock. You can see it. It has a lot of kind of salmon color in it from the feldspar, and we'll look at that. I have a number of these microscopes, these little keychain microscopes. You'll be using these in Yellowstone to look at crystals and things like that. I think they're all gone now, but if you will leave your note for me, I'd be glad to send you one of those. They're $5 each, and you can have, especially those of you who are going to Yellowstone, you might want to have one of those. Or you can be like John. He'll go around and John will say, hey, can I borrow that for a minute? You know, you can do that, you see. Okay, so we'll be able to collect some rhyolite material from Yellowstone. Next slide, look at the, along the canyon area, we'll meet at the rock wall there. It's a beautiful rock wall they've constructed out of the rhyolite lava that came out of Yellowstone. And we'll be able to see the little crystals in it. It's really quite fascinating. But you can see the flow banding in that. Can you see that, those lines? That's where the lava has flowed. Rhyolite is kind of like it's a very pasty lava, almost like bread dough. And it moves very slowly, and so it doesn't move very far from its eruptive center. It's unlike the black lava, the black basalt lava, like Hawaii, that is kind of like molasses, and it flows very rapidly and travels a great distance. And we'll see the difference in those lavas as we look. One of the places that we'll see in Yellowstone is called Obsidian Cliff. Now, this is an amazing thing. This is 5.5 square miles of volcanic glass. This is pure quartz. Quartz is a mineral that makes up rhyolite lava. So obsidian is a type of rhyolite flow. Well, why is it black? It's supposed to be made up of quartz. Well, it's black because of all the iron in it. There's a lot of iron. And this is an amazing feature, this obsidian cliff. By the way, the obsidian has been used to make arrowheads, and it's been found as far away as South America. So there had to be some trading going on with Indians up in this area. There was one tribe that is known for sure to have inhabited Yellowstone area called the Sheep Eaters. We'll talk about that here in a little bit. The Sheep Eaters, because they lived off the sheep and the mountain goats. And it's amazing. You don't find them around there anymore. You have to go way, way back up in the mountains to see them. And it tells you life was a lot different in the 1800s than it is even today. But that's why they were called Sheep Eaters. Anyway, this is obsidian. We may be able to climb around on it. I've done this in the past. There are signs that warn you about taking the obsidian. Don't do it. It is a holy relic, and you could be tarred and feathered, and you will get a big, big fine. This is a no-no. But I've been told that you're not supposed to climb around on it either. I've never seen any signs, but I will check that out, because one of the things I do with the groups that I bring there is we climb around in the obsidian so you can actually get a close-up look of it. Why just drive by and say, there's obsidian cliff? Okay, and we'll drive by. You know, there's no... You have to park, and you have to cross the highway and get up into it to really appreciate it, and I'll double-check that. Now, there is a another feature here that we'll see in Yellowstone called the basalt narrows. Now, basalt is a type of lava. There you see the black lava. It's made up of darker minerals, and you notice the columns there? Well, for some reason, when basalt, and all lavas do this, but basalt in particular, as it's flowing around and then begins to cool and crystallize, it contracts. And it contracts into these geometric columns. Some of them are five-sided, some six, some seven. But they're very neat to see that. Here are the Sheep Eater cliffs. You can see one of the groups standing there. So there's the Sheep Eater cliffs. And moms, dads, please keep your kids from climbing on that thing. They will climb it, I guarantee you. But it is very dangerous. These basalt columns do fall quite easily. It shows you really how young they are. After a million years of, what was it? How many geologic activities in 1 million years? Earthquakes, 300 million, something like this. You know, you'd think they'd, what? They're not, they shouldn't even be there at all. But it's very, very fragile. Anyway, that's Sheep Eater Cliffs, and that's a neat place, and we will try to get it. Those of you who will be driving motorhomes or pulling trailers, you'll stop at the entrance and just park your motorhome there, and then you can walk the quarter mile or so it is. It's not very long. It's very hard to turn around once you get up into there. So when we get to Sheep Eater Cliffs, I'll remind you of that when we get there. Here's kind of a volume of the eruptions. I don't know if you can read this. Anyway, the first... You've got four big eruptions there that are listed. Three of those are Yellowstone eruptions. The ones with the arrows over them are the Yellowstone eruptions. There was one there, I believe, of Tambora. But then on the very end, you see Mount St. Helens? You can barely see it. That's how much material was erupted from Mount St. Helens compared with the Yellowstone eruptions. And it gives you a little bit of an idea. This is incredible. If you look at Yellowstone, compare the next slide, you can see Mount St. Helens right next to the Yellowstone eruptions. The pyroclastic flows alone. Now, this doesn't include the ash and the lava. Pyroclastic means fire broken. And there are these clouds of ash and volcanic rock that travel at incredible speeds. But just the pyroclastic material alone was 2,500 times that of Mount St. Helens. Now that's a lot of stuff. And it blew out pumice, which is all glass. And it blew out this stuff called tuff. It's actually ash and bits of volcanic rock that are superheated as much as 1,800 degrees. And as it settles to the ground, it compacts and forms very solid rock. And we're going to see some of this stuff, the Huckleberry Ridge. I'm not sure why they call it Huckleberry, but it's the Huckleberry Ridge. And it's almost 100 feet high, this stuff. It's all over the place. We'll be able to see that. And if you look, here's an example of a pyroclastic flow, I think in the Philippines. It travels as much as 400 to 500 miles per hour, and it strips, it sandblasts everything. When we think of volcanic ash, and that's really not a good name for it because it's not burnt. It's tiny shards of glass and volcanic rock that act as a sandblaster. When Mount St. Helens erupted, it laid all these trees over like toothpicks and stripped them bare of all the bark and the branches. They're just like bare trees now, just laying down. Incredibly fast, superheated steam and volcanic rocks that are moving through there like a sandblaster. And boy, you can imagine the devastation this would have caused. Everybody within a 250-mile radius of Yellowstone would have been incinerated very, very quickly. So, you know, Billings, Montana, gone. Missoula, gone. Casper, gone. You know, Idaho, some of the cities in Idaho, gone. Just like that. They say that Mount St. Helens blew, and that was a very small volcanic eruption. There was a geologist named Johnston who was an observer. They didn't expect Mount St. Helens to blow out the side. They thought it was going to blow straight up. But the side caved in, and it blew out the side. And when he saw the earthquake happening, he radioed in and said, "I think this is it." Those were his last words. The pyroclastic flow went right beyond him another 6 miles or so. And it just, they've found not a trace. It just shows you how powerful this stuff is. And when you think of catastrophes, God obliterated the earth. And this is one of the reasons we don't have a clue where the Garden of Eden was. It would have been obliterated. Everything that existed prior to the flood would have been totally erased. Everything. This was a flood of, it wasn't just a bathtub overflow. This thing was meant to erase any vestige of the good stuff that existed, that God had intended to exist beforehand. Obliterated it. And it was quite devastating. Now, you want to get an idea of how much material was deposited from, or ejected and deposited from these volcanoes? Here's remnants of volcanic ash from one of the Yellowstone eruptions south of Casper. Isn't that incredible? Kansas, of all places. Look at this. This is a study done by Kansas State University. It's the same stuff that's on the top of Mount Everest in Yellowstone. This is in Kansas, in western Kansas. Ash, volcanic ash. Here's some more pictures. Isn't that incredible? Remnants of volcanic ash. Here's the next picture from one of the Yellowstone eruptions near Walsenburg. All the way down here. As far south and east as Louisiana, they've discovered the ash from Yellowstone. So everything would have been part of this devastating consequences. Here's one from Scott's Bluff, Nebraska. Look at that. Cliff of just solid ash. And you get an idea of how powerful it was because when you see Mount St. Helens, this is the ash fall in 1980. I mean, it was nuisance, but not very much. My mom told me that in Montana, where she was living, south central Montana, they had to sweep it off the roofs and the cars and things. But it wasn't thick like the stuff we saw. If you go around Yellowstone, Yellowstone is surrounded by a lot of different kinds of mountains. The Gallatin Mountains up north there, around where Mammoth is, made up of volcanic material. And the largest petrified logs, Yellowstone calls them forests, but it's a misnomer. There were no forests that we know of. This was all wood that washed in from other locations. But the Gallatin Mountains have the most abundant petrified wood in the world in these volcanic mountains. The same stuff that forms part of the Specimen Ridge thing. And then the Beartooth Mountains that we'll go into. It's a very studied mountain. the Beartooth Mountains are. Some of the oldest rocks in the world are supposed to be located there, as much as 3-point-something billion years old. And so a lot of geologists come from all over the world. There's a geological institute there in Red Lodge that's been there since the 1930s studying the Beartooth Mountains. And we have to address this. Are they really that old? If they're that old, the Bible can't be true. Isn't that right? I don't care what you do with the word day. It can't be made to say the same things that the geologists are telling us. So a lot of people credit volcanism. In fact, there were two groups of scientists in the 1800s that helped form early modern geologists. One were called the Neptunists, and the others were called the Vulcanists. The Neptunists often get lumped in with the creationists, and it's just not true. The guy by the name of Abraham Werner was a mineralogist. He was a quite popular professor in the 1800s. He was a Neptunist, which meant that the Earth had been formed by successive floods. A little bit close to the Noah idea, but not quite. But this happened over millions of years, of course. And, of course, he was scorned and ridiculed, and he had his followers. And then there were the Vulcanists, led by guys like Hutton, who was the founder of modern geologists, who really believed that the Earth was formed out of fire. And one of the reasons they came to that conclusion is because they saw all the volcanic rock around, and they had to come up with an explanation for it. Well, you know, if you reject the flood, if you reject creation, if you reject the Bible story, then obviously you're going to come to the conclusion that the earth began out of a molten ball of fire and lava and cooled and precipitated water and oxygen and so on. You know the story. And so I got to thinking about that. I go, wait a minute. Let's look at the products of volcanism here. First of all, volcanoes produce a lot of hydrogen. Too much of it, and it'll suffocate you. And what does that say for the beginning of life? Second of all, volcanoes produce hydrogen chloride, turns to hydrochloric acid upon contact with the atmosphere. Have you ever played with hydrochloric acid or sulfuric acid or nitric acid? We used to get this stuff as kids and play with it. You can't do it anymore. The last time I bought hydrochloric acid for testing things, and I'll bring some of that along, by the way, I had to go through an FBI screening to make sure I wasn't a terrorist. Hydrogen sulfide, very poisonous, corrosive, flammable, explosive. Dissolved in water, it makes sulfuric acid. Carbon monoxide, toxic to humans and animals. Carbon dioxide, poisonous when mixed with water, produces carbonic acid, corrosive. Can you imagine? And humans are to blame for all the carbon dioxide? Well, what about these big volcanoes? I mean, certainly the Park Service has got to share some responsibility, right? They're the ones that are trying to preserve this stuff and push the knowledge of it. Well, if that's true, Yellowstone did its share of introducing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. And listen, in the midst of developing life and evolving life, what is this going to do to any chances of survival, especially Yellowstone? It's going to obliterate it. And then you have lahars. Now, lahar is a French word. Next slide shows you a picture of lahars. This one, the bottom one, is of Mount St. Helens. These are rolling masses of logs and rock and mud, just carving everything out in its place. When I do field trips to Mount Rainier, I take the kids to a lahar from Mount Rainier, and it wiped out a town there several years ago. And it's just this strip about a quarter mile wide, and I don't know how deep it is, but it's got tons and tons and tons of boulders and rocks that have come down off of Mount Rainier and just scoured a path of these things. Lahars are very dangerous. And there are 250,000 idiots that live right around the base of Mount Rainier. And it's called the most dangerous volcano in the world because of the lahars. And that's the prime real estate is right down around Mount Rainier. Okay, so we've looked at these. Now look at the last product of volcanism, which is glassy pumice. and that will suffocate animals. Here's an example. In Nebraska, the ashfall fossil beds, these are animals thought by geologists to have been suffocated by ash from one of the Yellowstone eruptions. Ashfall fossil beds. That means there are tons of these animals there. And they look like they've all been suffocated. They've been able to look at the bones, and the bones all have these signs of a disease that would have been inherited from a consuming glass in the lungs and so on. And so they really feel it came from Yellowstone. And then last of all, we should just notice that volcanoes are really instruments of destruction, not of creation. And from a biblical perspective, it's my opinion that volcanoes really surfaced during the flood and after, not a part of the original creation. They are fractures in the earth. They're big pimples that have popped in the earth. That's a good way to look at it. Kind of descriptive, isn't it? It's these scars in the earth that produce all kinds of poisonous stuff. And they would not have been a part of forming any kind of stuff. Okay, we're next going to look at the geysers and the hot springs and so on. Why don't you stand up, stretch, and take a breath. While you're stretching, parents, when you come on this thing, really keep close eye on your kids. The water is very, very hot in these things. And even sticking your finger down in it to play around can burn you. It's so hot. So be sure to have all the kids stay on the walkways and not to touch the stuff. It's very, very hot. Okay, let's go through the geysers and the hot springs and the fumaroles and the mud pots. All signs of volcanism in Yellowstone. Okay, what's necessary for these kinds of things to take place? Well, first of all, you need a heat source. Something has to heat that water up down below. Now, we've never seen this. It's so far down there, maybe anywhere from 2 to 5 miles. Drilling is only, what, in some places only gone as far as maybe 2 miles, maybe a little more than 2 miles. So we don't actually know what's down there. But there seems to be magma, these big pools of hot liquid rock or semi-liquid rock. They're very, very hot. And then you need a renewal water source, rain or snow melt. Water from the geysers erupts, and then it all goes back into the ground and starts to cycle over again. And then you need fractured rock. Water reservoirs in the rock down below gets trapped and then forced out by pressure. And so we need a place where all this water can accumulate and then do it time after time after time after time after time. And then you need permeable rock. Of course, this would be the Ice Age gravels. It's very interesting if you look at the kind of the chronology here. On top is a very thin layer of what we call sinter. It's the white geyserite rock that's been forms a very hard rock out of this geyser water that moves through lava, the hardened lava, and dissolves it on its way up and then redeposits it on the surface. And that's the sinter. You'll see that all over Yellowstone. It's the white stuff, the white crusty stuff you'll see. This is a picture of Old Faithful and Beehive. This is called the Upper Geyser Basin, and we'll spend considerable time at the Upper Geyser Basin. And if you're fortunate, you'll be able to see Beehive Geyser. Let me just tell you, though, this picture, we took this picture, and the whole team was on the other side. We knew just where to stand, of course, and the water just sprayed them. So they're on the other side of the direction the water's moving. So make sure when you go, if you want to stick with us, you can. Or you can go off and do your own exploring, and you'll get drenched by Beehive Geyser. It's a wonderful eruption to see, and it goes off quite regularly. Of course, you'll want to see Old Faithful go off. That's quite spectacular, and it just draws in hundreds of people to see it. And of course, everybody claps, you know. The show's over, you know. This. We're also going to see a place called Norris Geyser Basin. Number of thermal features in Yellowstone is estimated at 10,000. Norris Geyser Basin is the hottest basin in the park, that is temperature-wise. It's not the place of what's happening now. It's the warmest place. The Carnegie Institute made test wells in 1929 to determine subsurface temperature. One test hole was abandoned at 265 feet when the temperature reached 401 degrees. The steam pressure threatened to destroy the drilling rig. So it gets hot down there, really hot. And if you look at the anatomy of a geyser, this is what they think it looks like anyway. I think Genesis does a good job of explaining it. Let's look at it. Well, first of all, the fountains of the great deep, that would have helped deposit the rhyolite flows and the eruptions of Yellowstone. You have thousands of feet of lava in Yellowstone. They do not know how thick this stuff really is. But thousands of feet, that's a catastrophic explanation of that, not a gradual thing. And so the Genesis flood explains that very adequately. Fountains of the great deep bursting open. It's going to release tons and tons of magma and lava. The post-flood period of volcanism and ice age, you see there, depositing what we call alluvial gravels on top of the rhyolite lava is all this gravel. Where did the gravel come from? Well, it's product of glacial movement, ice movement. Drags everything in but the kitchen sink, and then it just melts and deposits it there. Yellowstone is covered by this gravel. And then in places where there are geysers, of course, on top of the gravel is the center, volcanic center. And this all just very, very nicely explained by Genesis. Geyser formation and hot steam and water flowing through the alluvial gravels and then the siliceous center, the geyserite, covering it. Rhyolite lava, we said, was made up of a lot of quartz, and we'll see this when we look at it under these little microscopes we have. You'll see lots of quartz in the rhyolite. Quartz is a light-colored mineral, very hard mineral, and it forms the rhyolite lava. So when this hot water comes from underneath the ground, it's under a lot of pressure, a lot of carbon dioxide in it. Of course, we said that produces the carbonic acid, which goes through the rhyolite in the cracks and the crevices, dissolves it, and then as it flies out in the geysers and the fumaroles and things, it deposits this stuff on the ground. As the water evaporates, the solid that's left is the sinter, or the geyserite. Be sure that you don't go through, especially if you wear glasses, don't go through these steam clouds that you see. Oh, this will be fun. Let's go through the steam coming off it and go through the geyser spray and stuff, because it leaves geyserite on your lenses, and it's impossible to get off. It precipitates it, just like it does in the ground here. So you want to be very careful. You go through those steam things for fun. Something I could see Mitch doing, a lot, just for fun. Take off your glasses and cover your cameras, because it will ruin the lenses there. Excuse me?
You will remind us.
I'll try to remind you. There'll be lots of stuff going on, lots of stuff. You guys will have a lot of fun. Okay, and now the third geologic activity we see going on in the park is ice. Ice, lots and lots of ice. So here's the question. Is there evidence for an ice age? And if so, where would it fit in the biblical view? I taught Christian high school for a number of years, and one of my jobs was to take every freshman from and sophomore, junior, and senior through the Bible, teaching every verse. That was the goal. And so the question would always come up. Kids ask questions. Well, how do you fit dinosaurs in here? How do you fit all the woolly mammoths and the ice? Where does that fit in all of this stuff? And, one of the things that happened to me as a kid when I began to get real interested in this stuff as a second grader, and I'd spend lots and lots of time at the library looking at books, and the older I got, I'd spend more time reading. And so by the time I got into high school, I was thoroughly entrenched in the uniformitarian view. And Adam and Eve and Noah's Ark became a myth to me. In fact, I remember asking my priest one day, I said, I'm really conflicted here. Confused would have been too big of a word for a teenager, wouldn't it have? Confused, that would have been better. And I was confused. When did Adam and Eve, or when did Neanderthal man become Adam and Eve? Because that's what I was saying. Neanderthal man was older than Adam and Eve. So when did they become? At what point did they become Adam and Eve? And the priest told me, he said, look, I don't know, but I wouldn't worry about it. Just believe what the church teaches you and you'll be fine. And so I went to college, and first 3 years of college were hell for me and for my parents. And it was because I just rejected it all. And why? Because I was trained, not by my parents were good parents. I can think back now to my parents. I cannot tell you. I'm sure they made mistakes. But I cannot tell you what I would describe as a major mistake my parents made in bringing us up. They were wonderful parents. And we had a good, close community. I remember my childhood with fondness. But secretly and behind the scenes, the secular world was doing its work. And so, boy, when I became a believer then, not because I'd seen the evidence, because my life was falling apart and I knew it, became a believer, well, the first question in my mind is what? What about the stuff with the flood? I mean, I believe Jesus rose from the dead. New Testament tells me that, but it's combined with the Old Testament, and the Old Testament has these ridiculous stories I used to make fun of. You know, like Noah's flood, what? So I had to resolve that. And so the more I studied some of the geology and stuff involved and began to ask questions, I was kicked out of my freshman geology class. Just the question, I was a little bit arrogant too, but anyway, I just began to see, boy, a lot of stuff has been withheld. The whole story was not told here. And so as we begin to tell the story, we begin to see things that may not be covered by the Bible, but will fit within a biblical time frame. Let's do that here. The Ice Age, when? Okay, let's do a timeline here. Of course, the first thing in the Bible is the creation. Roughly 6,000 years ago, about 1,600 years before the flood. Now, I'm saying about. You know, some of you literalists here will get into it could be 1,600 years in 2 days, you know, because you're allowing for the first and second day of creation, so on and so forth. So roughly, okay, 1,600 years between the creation and the flood. Abraham came about 290 years after the flood, and then Joseph about 650 years after the flood, and Moses about 950 years after the flood. Now, we don't have a whole lot of time for an ice age, do we? It's got to fit in there somewhere. Well, first of all, we know it didn't occur before the flood. It's a very perfect world. That just doesn't exist anymore. Any vestiges of an ice age that occurred before the flood would have been wiped out in the flood. So I can safely conclude, well, that eliminates the first 1,600 years. So it's got to fit somewhere between the flood and Moses' time. Otherwise, as you multiply the historical witnesses and so on, a lot more, I believe, would have been said about this ice. So anyway, let's work with those parameters. Well, if the flood world was destroyed, then you've got the Yellowstone eruptions, makes sense, being somehow related to the flood. And then all the volcanism would have changed the climatic conditions of the earth for a while. Can you imagine that much ash going into the atmosphere? It would produce a nuclear winter in parts of the world. That's just the science of it. And that would set up this period of an ice age. Rapid ice buildup, maybe 500 years or so of ice buildup, and then as the volcanism subsided, you don't have any more eruptions like Yellowstone. The eruptions get far and fewer between and less violent. Now you're going to have rapid melting, and that accounts for a lot of the ice age dam breaches you see all over the world. So we're really dealing with a period of between Noah and Moses. And it would have been primarily As you look at the next slide here, in the northern hemisphere, that's where most of the ice age evidence is, the northern hemisphere, which, of course, is where we live. And in the higher latitudes, there are mountains in, there's some evidence of an ice age in Israel. I was real surprised to find this out. Not in the lowlands, but in the upper, the higher latitudes. And all over the world, in the higher latitudes, there's evidence of a lot more ice at one time. Now, geologists will readily tell you these are from the ice age, but they don't look at it as an ice age anymore. When I was a kid, there were probably 4 to 8 ice ages. Today, now they're considered 24, at least 24. So what are we looking at here? Are we looking at a contradiction in the Bible, or are we looking at ebbs and flows of one massive ice sheet building up and then rapidly melting? That's a good question. You need three mechanisms to produce an ice age. You need volcanic aerosols, and these all have to be working together, by the way. We have different volcanic aerosols that have been shown to reduce the temperature in our atmosphere. Some of the volcanic eruptions in the past have actually reduced the atmospheric temperature a couple of degrees. So we know they do produce an effect, but you also need warmer oceans. Warmer oceans would result in more evaporation. Into a cooler atmosphere, you're going to get a lot of condensation or a lot of moisture. But all of those have to be working in concert. There have been over 100 explanations of how you could have an ice age offered by the secular world. Not one of them are accepted. Today, the ice age or ice ages are the most mysterious thing in modern geology. They cannot figure out what would produce an ice age. But you've got to have a number of factors together, and the flood definitely would produce that. Here's a map of Yellowstone Park as you're going to see it driving through it. And then here's a picture as it looked like with the ice coverage. Over 3,000 feet of ice covered almost all of Yellowstone. And this is all found in the evidence that you see on the ground and in the mountains up there. Here are the Beartooth Mountains. You're going to see Pilot Peak and Index Peak. You'll get a good shot of those. Those are called horns. And horns are the glacial remnants of the ice carving out of the rock. The Matterhorn is another example of a glacial horn. Well, these are really high. These mountains are over 11,000 feet or close to 11,000 feet. Index Peak and so on. That's a lot of ice. And then you see the glacial trough. So you will be driving right along this glacial trough in the Beartooths. This is a couple thousand feet deep. It's a glacial trough is a U-shaped valley. You see them all over Alaska today. And yet there's no glaciers in there today. Now they get a lot of snowfall. We've been up there at times where there have been 13, 14, 15 feet of snow, and following the snow plow, you know. And they use these huge things. They look like big train locomotives, and they're just throwing the stuff out, you know, one lane, and we're following behind it, maybe us and maybe one other car. Kind of a stupid thing to do, but adventurous, you know. And so we go through this thing, and then they close the park. But by middle of summer, the snow's all gone. We'll see patches of it when we get up there, but the snow comes and it goes. Glaciers, however, boy, they stick around. A couple of other things we'll see in the Beartooth Mountains. The Beartooth Highway runs right by a feature called the Bear's Tooth, which is what the Beartooths are named after. It's a glacial horn, something that was carved by moving glaciers. But here's the other thing not many people notice. Look at the top of the Beartooth, and it's called the Beartooth Plateau, which is a flat surface, for a reason. You see that up there? What would produce a flat surface in 11,000-foot peak? Well, the flood explanation, because obviously if there's erosion happening over 100 million years, in the case of the Beartooth, 2 billion years, certainly the plateaus are all going to be dissected, wouldn't you think? Well, how much rain can fall in 2 billion years? It's a lot of rain that could do a lot of damage, a lot of freezing, a lot of thawing, a lot of moving around. These are flat surfaces. Well, if you look at it from the biblical framework, you would see that probably those mountains were much lower. They represent basement rock, so perhaps they were part of the original creation and then changed or metamorphosed during the tectonic activity of the flood. Then shortly toward the end of the flood, shortly after, the mountains were raised up. They would have been raised up as the floodwaters were receding. And the floodwaters were powerful enough to plane surfaces. And now you've got the remnant up here at about 11,000 feet. And then the glacier set in after the flood there. So it's nicely explained by the flood. Now look at the glacial trough there. There's another valley we'll go right by. This is a fantastic highway here. Charles Kuralt called it the most beautiful highway in America. I mean, this is really, it's an all-American highway, and very, very nice drive. You'll be thrilled by it. It's just, my mother hated it because, you know, you've got hairpin curves and there's switchbacks back and forth, and my dad would like to play around with us as kids, you know. He'd get real close to the edge, you know. And my mom would just be a nervous wreck by the time we got to our destination. She hated the Beartooth Highway. So there's a lot of this kind of stuff up there. Here's some more evidence of glacial activity. Here's a glacial plain in Yellowstone where you see some V-cut channels from melting water over volcanic rock. So again, if you look at the chronology, you've got the volcanism being laid down first and then the glacial stuff on top of it. That fits perfectly with the flood chronology. Here's an example of some more glacial activity. In Yellowstone, you'll see glacial moraines. These are actually where glaciers have been moving along and carrying rock and debris and then halted. And what they left behind were these rims of glacial debris. And these are called moraines. There are lateral moraines from the side, and then there are terminal moraines at the edge. In fact, if you go the way I suggested to John, it was come up from Fort Collins through the Tetons, right there at Jenny Lake. Jenny Lake is a glacial lake that was produced by a glacier being surrounded by these moraines melting, and that's what you're seeing. Glacier is a glacial lake. And you can see the moraine around it that holds Jenny Lake in. It's really quite something. Another glacial feature are what we call kettles. These are these little ponds up at 10,000 feet or so. You know, they're just ponds. There's no water flowing in, no water flowing out. But they're ponds, and they're from glacial melt. Now, I don't know about you, but after 25,000 years, which is when the last ice age supposedly ended, I would think that ponds may have been dried up by now. 25,000 years, that's a long, long, long time. But these are vestiges of the ice that covered Yellowstone, and not too long ago, within the last 4,500 years. And then the boulders that are out of place, you see those strewn all over the place? Those are called erratics. Interesting thing about those boulders are they're granite. They've been transported from 50 miles away into volcanic country. What? How did that happen? Well, glaciers. It's the only way to explain erratics. They're boulders that are in places should not be. Look at this next picture. We'll drive right by these. These are granite, and they're just sitting there. And they say, wow, how'd they get there? You know, glaciers covered the area. Look at this next one here. There's a sign put up by the park system, Glacier Boulder. Now, I didn't put that up there. They did. It's a glacial boulder, granite. It's sitting right on top, right next to Canyon, the Grand Canyon of Yellowstone, just sitting there right on the edge. Here's another picture of the erratics. Now, here's a good picture here showing the Beartooth Mountains in the background and an erratic, a granite erratic, in front. The Beartooths are made up of both granite and a metamorphosed rock. So here's one of these granite boulders. Isn't that interesting? They move there. The powerful force of these glaciers. Here's an aerial view of the Hayden Valley we'll drive into. This is a glacial valley. And you see all of the ripple marks in it, signs of glacial movement. In Gardner, right outside of Gardner, those of you who are staying in the Western Air Motel, you get a nice shot of the Electric Peak, which is right across the way. It got its name because the early explorers encountered an unusual number of electric or lightning strikes, and so they gave it the name Electric Peak. But right there, you can see a glacial, we call a cirque. It's where a glacier had formed and then carved it out like an amphitheater. And those are all over the park. You have a lot of those up here in the Front Range. And then the peaks there in the glacier or in Electric Peak are types of glacial horns. So what would bring on an ice age? Well, cooler atmosphere, warmer oceans, and increased evaporation and condensation. Those combined would certainly do the trick. Okay, I want you to stand and take a little, just a break. If you need to use the restroom, fine. We're going to cover a couple of last things that will be interesting. Kids, you're going to encounter some things on microbes. I'll have a little workbook for you, too, on this trip. But all of these geysers and hot water and steam things and so on have little tiny microbes in them. And they are very, very interesting. So we'll talk about that here in just a couple of minutes.
With all of the volatility that is going on during the flood, how do we explain the ark?
What do you mean? The
Noah's Ark.
You mean surviving it? Yeah, go ahead.
This is bringing up my question. I think you should just wrap this up as relatively soon.
Okay.
Leave time for general questions.
Okay.
Like this one about the ark.
Okay.
There's probably a ton of questions.
All right. Well, what I'll do is, and we'll miss Specimen Ridge, but I'll talk to you about that later. I'll show you some interesting quotes, but we'll bypass that.
I think, like Jenny, there's a bunch of people here that may have, like, with some answers.
Okay, good idea. We'll do that.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
You can ask it now, too, but maybe you should wait, because other people may have the same question.
Okay.
I think there are the really good general questions, and that's one.
Okay. Yeah, we can do that very easily. Yeah. Worldview Academy.
Bill Jack.
You know, I'm kind of familiar with it, but I've not been directly associated with it, but I've heard of it.
You know, the reason I ask this is because my kids have been involved with it, but these four questions, I just Googled their website, and I have a series of I'm just showing how to use these questions when you walk into a museum or when you're on the street.
Oh, yeah. Are you going on the Yellowstone thing?
I wish I was.
Okay. I was going to say, if there was a way, why don't you type these out, put a little explanation for them, and give it to Danny and have her send it out to all the people who are signed up to go on the Yellowstone thing, because I'm sure Danny is... Yeah, and she's around here. She's kind of taking care of some of the logistics. But she'll make sure that that gets out to everybody. And those would be very good questions to ask.
Yes.
And so, yeah, do that. Could you do that? Type it out? And then make sure you could even give it, where's Pat's wife? You could even give it to her when you're done. Yeah, either that or take that and just tear it out and give it to Danny and just said I suggested that she just mail that out to all the Yellowstone participants. And just these are questions that you can be asking as we go through the park.
Okay.
I think it's a good idea.
They have a whole segment on going through the different natural history museum with this. And then he has his video series actually shows him interacting with people and how these questions can get people to think.
Yeah, no, I think it's a great idea.
So
yeah, it's a great idea. Well, and we kind of put this thing together. John and I were sitting around one day and said, he said, hey, could you put this on if I got a group of people together? I said, yeah, sure. So I normally lead a group of families through Yellowstone also every year. And it's mostly through the homeschool network, you know, that I get involved with. And but there are families from all over the United States who join us, and we go in. But we're going to start doing this on a regular basis every year.
You know, and we have such a week. Did you homeschool your kids?
We did.
We did, too. And I mean, this type of thing that you go, let's look at the other side of things.
Yeah, yeah.
So,
oh, it's a great idea. It's, yeah.
I appreciate you doing this.
Well, thank you.
Taking your lives, just like John, and listening to him. There's no way that I'm going to remember this stuff, but taking something that you love and you have a passion for and really
yeah. Yeah, I understand.
Okay, I'll find Danny.
Okay, yeah. Okay, folks. And they wonder why our kids don't listen to us. Here's what we're going to do. I'm going to just share just a little bit on these microbes, and then we're going to bypass the rest of it, and I'll just open it up to questions. The last part of this is devoted to the whole Specimen Ridge thing, the petrified, so-called petrified forest, but we'll just save that. So a little bit on the microbes. You know, Yellowstone has all these beautiful hot springs and so on, and you'll notice the variations in the colors in the water. Why does the water have all these variations of color? You know, maybe all the way from a blue to a green to a red, you know, this kind of thing. Well, it's due to the microbes. Different thermophiles or heat-loving bacteria or cyanobacteria, I'm not sure exactly if they know what to call them. There are these interesting critters that live at different temperatures. Some can live at extremely high temperatures. And then the different colors represent the different cyanobacteria that live at different temperatures. And that's what creates the colors. And here in the beginning in about the 80s, with, you know, the advent of microbiology and so on, they began studying these microbes. Now, this picture here is one of our tours. I had this group of young kids that just kind of hung on everything. That's kind of fun, just to have that. Look, but they, you know, everywhere I'd go, there'd be, they were asking questions, doing all kinds of things. And I was pointing out the microbes to them in the water and fascinated by them. But anyway, I picked up this book several years ago at Yellowstone called Seen Unseen, and on the study of the microbes. Fascinating book. And, of course, you know, the evolutionary view for a long time is that these creatures were primitive. And they were in the process of evolving. Now, no one's ever stopped to ask the question, okay, wait a minute. Why are they still around? Did they not become obsolete? I mean, isn't that what evolution states? That, you know, you have creatures that developed and they gave rise to creatures that could adapt to the changing environments and so on. And then there were some who became extinct. Well, these microbes have supposed to have been around at the beginning of life on the planet. That's almost a billion years ago, according to geology, and yet they're still here. They had some variation, but they're still here. And so I was fascinated to read this book and seeing the perspective on it, and I got to the end of the book, and it's reasons for studying the microbes of Yellowstone. And I expected to see all the medical advances and everything like this, you know. I thought, oh, this ought to be interesting. Well, that was included in the list, but that wasn't first on the list. You know what was the first thing, reason? Number one reason for the grants and the motivation and so on for getting into studying these microbes?
Finding
the link, but on other planets. How could we explain life beginning on other planets? And I thought, what? What a letdown. I thought they were going to be, you know, the very first thing we've discovered, these breakthroughs in medical technology, and that's the main motivation for all the funding and tax dollars and everything else. No, they're interested in life in outer space and how the microbes of Yellowstone might satisfy that curiosity. Okay, it provides jobs, fine. But, you know, I think the thing with these microbes we can say for sure is that no life can be considered primitive. All life, I don't care how simple it looks, is very complex. And you see that picture of the amoeba there. Very complex creature, and yet that's supposed to be one of the most primitive creatures. And wow, this is, God created life. It all has to be complex. None of it can be considered simple or primitive. And that's I think that's one of the biggest changes that needs to take place in our own worldview, as even as believers, that all life made by the Creator is complex and totally escapes our imagination as human beings. That's a fundamental thing that I think it has to happen in our worldview to see that. These are not accidents that happened here. And then the last slide here on, this is called Turbid Lake at Pelican Valley. We'll go by some of this stuff. These are the mud pots. You've heard of the mud pots or the paint pots. These are really kind of interesting things. You know, why are they different from all other geysers or fumaroles or things like this? Well, there are parts of the park that are very acidic. Some are very alkaline, but parts of the park are very acidic. And so there are microbes that there's an interesting exchange between the acidic water, these microbes that live on it, and the production of sulfuric acid. And the acid eats away at the center and produces this mud. And that's why you have the paint pots. But it's the interaction of the acidic water and these microbes that live on it. Isn't that interesting? Producing these paint pots. And to the degree that there's water, these paint pots will be quite active. When the water level goes down, there's very little activity, and you'll see steam and stuff coming out. So Yellowstone is a very, it's a very dynamic place. And, I mean, 3,000 earthquakes a year, as many as 3,000 earthquakes a year under Yellowstone. So the place is constantly changing in its dynamics. So we should witness a lot of neat things while we're there. Okay, what I'd like to do is end there and just kind of open it up in the time remaining here. If you have questions about material or about some of the things we've covered in this. Any questions? Yes, go ahead. Yeah, you had a question. And nice and loud so people can hear.
When we consider the volatility of the flood, and the fact that it was
Yeah.
But how did they survive?
Yeah, so you're talking about during the flood with all the stuff. I mean, there must have been hypercanes and everything else going around. Well, that's a very good question. I was fascinated by some studies done by the U.S. Navy years ago, back in the 70s. In fact, there was a neat movie made on called The Discovery of Noah's Ark. If you can get your hands on it, it's really quite a fascinating video. And the U.S. Navy had done some research on the seaworthiness of the Ark. It was virtually impossible to sink it and to capsize it because of its dimensions. Now, we don't stop long enough to think about what Noah and his family went through. A lot of the animals probably hibernated. But Noah must have been one sick puppy. You know, I think about this. Years ago, my wife and I celebrated our 25th anniversary. We took a cruise, and the travel agent said, look, prevent seasickness here. I'm going to put you over here. This is the best place. And still with that, at night, man, you know, it was kind of floating around, and we need to take some, where's the bonine? You know, we need to take that stuff. And so we were taking that stuff because of the seasickness, you know. But Noah and his family must have gone through some hellacious stuff, you know, and trying to adapt to this year-long voyage. So, you know, not only is there the seaworthiness of the ark, but again, because our Christian belief is that God only made the world, but he's involved in it. God is, a lot of times, just not seen doing a lot of things that protect us, guide us, and lead us. There are times when I have just wrestled with God, and I, you know, how could you do this? What kind of a God are you? You know, I mean, I've had these conversations. And I can tell you, it's kind of almost like, okay, wait a minute, sit down. And let me tell you the facts of the story here. First of all, you know about 5% of what's going on. You don't know the other 95%, which is what God is involved in. So, you know, God just didn't turn Noah loose. We believe in a God who is involved. And I cannot explain the ark scientifically and the survival of the ark scientifically because God was involved. Science just has to acknowledge its limits, that's all. It's not the answer to everything. So I don't know if that helps with the answer or not about how Noah's ark would have survived. Now, after it landed, you know what landed on, it says the mountains of Ararat. We don't know which ones those were. But the big Mount Ararat is an extinct volcano. I don't know if you knew that. But if it's on that mountain, it would have been torn up by now. Because volcanic mountains, if you've ever been close, like for instance Mount Rainier, the mountain is made up of rock. And it's constantly shifting and cracking and rolling down and obliterating things. So if it landed there, I'm guessing probably it's gotten obliterated. And then there's quite a bit of uplift since then. So I don't know if that helps answer it. He would have been a sick man, though. He must have been. That was his first cruise. Yeah, that's... Any other questions?
And there's evidence since we've been here. And I, you know, heard John talk about this too a lot.
Yeah.
And then there's the older.
Yeah.
And the two are just about diametrically.
Yeah, one of the biggest dividing points in the church today is the old earth, young earth thing. Yeah, it's... with the whole argument, how to resolve it, the young earth, old earth. The only way to resolve that is to accept a straightforward view of Scripture. Once we start playing around with the meanings of words in Scripture, you're going to obliterate any real meaning at all. So, for instance, if we can't define what the word day means in Genesis, what does evening and morning mean? What does the word sun mean? What does the word earth mean? You know, all of a sudden we're left with this vacant doctrine. And that, so you've got to start somewhere. Is the Bible historically accurate? Is it spiritually reliable? Can we trust what it says? That is the fundamental question in the whole debate, because that will expose worldviews. Once you expose the worldview, then you begin to see the assumptions and the rationale that are behind a lot of the conclusions. Human beings are very clever, they're very intelligent, and motives and agendas are not always seen. And so there's going to be continued discoveries of so-called evidence, like this soft tissue. Instead of concluding the soft tissue would probably indicate the dinosaurs aren't that old, they conclude what an amazing thing it is that it's been preserved for 65 million years. Why? There's a worldview issue there. That's not an evidence issue. That's a worldview issue. And the only way to resolve it is to agree with what Genesis says. If it says what it says, and means what it says, everything else is a moot point. That means, then, that somebody's misinterpreting the evidence. Somebody's miscalculating the assumptions. That you got to start with the scriptures. Man shall not live by bread alone, but on every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. If we bypass that, you're in a quagmire over your head. You will never, ever be able to resolve the young earth, old earth question. Never. And so if I talk with people and they just are convinced that the young earth people are a bunch of idiots and they're not willing to investigate, I stop the conversation. It's not worth talking about evidence. Geologists know all the radiometric dating flaws. But because of their worldview, these are anomalies. And geologists are willing to live with anomalies so long as it doesn't upset the worldview. And once you attack the worldview, now you're changing the entire ballgame. So resolve it, first of all. We must be convinced the Bible is the Word of God, every word it states. Second of all, that it's a valid historical framework to interpret all of history. Israel, wars, man's problems, human life, creation, the flood. Is it that comprehensive? If I don't believe that, I'm going to really struggle with the so-called findings of science. And I've read enough scientific articles. I try to read about 100 of those a year just to stay up on what's happening. And the more I read those, the more I can spot, this is a guy's worldview coming out here. It's not scientific evidence. It's his worldview, and he doesn't see it, or he doesn't want to see it. So it's a worldview issue.
Share a couple things there. One, in our world, I am someone that holds the young earth view, and I feel like I have thought that through both biblically and scientifically. I feel real peaceful about that. I feel like it's a blessing in my life. I'm excited about holding that place because of how it works for me in so many different arenas in how I understand the world. But I also recognize I am in the minority among people who claim to believe in the Bible. Most evangelical Christians do not hold the view I hold. Most Christian colleges don't teach the view I hold. And so in my view that I hold, I have to be real humble, recognizing that there are people that love God just as much as I love God. That value truth just as much as I value truth, and yet somehow they come up with a different answer. And that means I have to recognize that within the sphere of faith, I'm going to meet brothers and sisters that I dearly need to love and respect, and that in some ways probably know parts of God better than I do, that hold a different view on this issue. So how I would answer your question, Terry, is how do I address this personally? I'd say one of two things. You accept the view of your leaders. That's how most people hold their view on this, whatever it is. That's how non-Christians find their view. They go, well, what if my leaders are scientists? What do they believe? I believe what they believe. I have no idea what's true myself. I could never figure it out. I just believe what they tell me. There's Christians that go, these are my spiritual leaders. I believe what they tell me. And they hold the younger view, they hold an older view, that's what I believe. That's really a great way to do that. And to be honest, that's the way most of us hold our convictions on challenging, difficult things. There is another thing you can do. You can investigate it for yourself. And you can go, I want to try to figure this out for myself. Hopefully that's what your leaders have done. Although the truth is, lots of Christian leaders and secular leaders, lots of scientists don't know why they believe what they believe either. They just accept it on the basis of authority in their field. you can be one of those people that goes, I'm going to figure it out myself. And even then, you may come up with different conclusions, but you will have your own convictions on that subject. Okay? So, so in the world here that you're in, you live in the realm where your leaders hold a young earth view because it's the most straightforward way to interpret the Bible. You take any person reading the Bible for the first time and they read Genesis and they're going to come up with, there's a God that created the world in 6 days and there was this big flood, and if there's anything clear about the Bible, it's that. But I don't take everything in the Bible literally. Some of it I reinterpret because of what I know about science. I do that. I just taught last week about Joshua. Joshua commanded the sun to stand still and the moon to stop. Well, I know enough astronomy to know that had that happened, that wouldn't have helped Joshua one bit, because it wasn't the sun stopping that didn't need it to happen. It was the rotation of the earth. So I reinterpret Joshua's words going, Joshua, I know that what you really mean is that you use the same vernacular we all talk about in the Bible, and the weathermen both talk about sunrise and sunset, and everybody knows the sun doesn't rise and set. The earth rotates. But we're fine with that language, but we don't take it literally when it's there. Some people feel like even though the literal way to take Genesis, the straightforward communication there, is 6 days and a flood, they go, ah, but you've got to reinterpret that. Some people go, I can't go that far in reinterpreting it. That's the view I hold. I, just like Patrick here, could talk all day long on why I believe the young earth view is a view that fits best with our world. But as we live in the Christian world, we have to recognize there's a place of humility and owning my own convictions, understanding why I hold them, and recognizing there's dear brothers and sisters that for whatever reason have been brought to a different place. And I don't look down on them. I have many friends who are pastors who do not believe what I believe. And I love them deeply and dearly. Some of them haven't thought it through that much. Some of them have. And so in my church, I'm going to do my best to be real honest about what I believe, and I'll be just love to share why, as everybody knows. But I also have a real recognition that this is not an issue to be condescending, because there's other people to be condescending to you. And so I just invite us to own our own convictions. If you want to own the convictions of your leaders, don't let anybody tell you that's a bad way to do it, because that's what almost everybody does in every arena. But if you want to know, then you can investigate it. And I believe you'll find lots of good reasons to come to solid convictions. And I think the convictions you come to would be a young earth view. But I just want us to recognize that we hold that view with a conviction based on something solid. We don't take that view in authority. If we did, we probably wouldn't hold the view we hold. We hold it because that's where we've gone and gotten our own convictions. So does anybody have any other convictions or any questions? About anything related to the creation model or stuff like that, that there's this spring on the heart. Plus, Pat will be here, and you could ask him questions afterwards. And I've thought about this a little bit too. You can ask me anytime.
Yeah, really.
All right. Well, can I just pray? And bring this to conclusion? Lord Jesus, I thank you for the beautiful world you made. Well, that's one thing we all agree on. I just think of those pictures of the mountains, and even though, like Patrick shared last night, even though it's marred and it's been destroyed, it's still beautiful. God, you have made so many beautiful things, and people take pictures of it and put it on calendars and posters because you've made a beauty there that touches the human heart, and that's from you. That's a picture of you. That's a measure of your character. And I just, Lord, I love the way that you reveal yourself and bless us. And I also thank you, God, for the incredible evidence. It just seems so clear to me of how your Bible is a simple, straightforward history of the world. And it is amazing how somehow that is not clear to more people. But God, we do acknowledge
that in the unsaved world, the wickedness of the human heart and the desire to push you away, and that makes so much sense in why men like Lyell and Hutton could not see you. They did not want to see you. They began with that premise, we will not see God. So how does this have to work so that we do not see God? So many people have followed that line of thinking. And we just pray, Lord Jesus, that you give us convictions that we find.